for your patience as we worked out a few details in getting the presentation uploaded. Welcome to the Francis E. Clark Distinguished Lectureship on Soil Biology. My name is Mary Stromberger. I'm the past chair of the Division of Soil Biology and Biochemistry. The Francis E. Clark Distinguished Lectureship on Soil Biology was created as an annual lecture presented by distinguished scholars at the SSSA annual meetings and honors Francis Clark's lifelong commitment to the greater understanding of soil, plant, and microbial interactions and of nutrient cycling in terrestrial ecosystems. The lectureship was established in 2001 by Dr. Francis Clark from the Colorado State University. Today, I am pleased to introduce Dr. Richard Burns as a 2015 lecturer. Unfortunately, Dr. Burns is not able to join us in person today. His wife, Wendy, is very ill, and she's not able to travel with him, and he's not able to leave her at this time. She is recovering. It's been a slow recovery, though. So what Richard has done, he has recorded a webinar, his presentation. So I will show that shortly. And then Richard will join us live following that via conference call for his Q&A. I won't go into a lot of details about Richard's background and his career, because he does that in his presentation. But I will say that Richard's research interests are many and include soil and water pollution, bioremediation, biotreatment of industrial waste, the rhizosphere, community activities in biofilms, soil aggregation, enzyme regulation and activity, soil microbial ecology and stress, and the problems of studying complex heterogeneous systems. He has published approximately 150 papers and has edited or authored many books on pollution, soil enzymes, and microbial ecology. Dr. Burns has served on numerous national and international committees, was co-founder of the successful Enzyme in the Environment conference series, and has been or is on the editorial boards of many journals, and is chief editor of a top-ranked soils journal whose name I will not mention in this audience. In 1992, he was presented with a gold medal by the world's oldest university, the University of Bologna, for his contributions to research and teaching in soil science. In Italy, in 2007, Richard was presented with a Lifetime Achievement Award for his outstanding contributions to our understanding of the microbiology and enzymology of soil. In 2008, he was awarded the Erskine Fellowship that took him to the University of Christchurch in New Zealand to lecture and initiate research collaborations there. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts and was recently designated as a distinguished talent by the Australian government and awarded citizenship. Nowadays, Richard divides his time between being professor of environmental microbiology and research consultant at the University of Queensland and professor of academic communication at the University of the Sunshine Coast. Today, Richard is presenting soil microbiology, past, present, and future, black box to white box to no box at all. For those of you who have had the joy and privilege of getting to know Richard, you'll know him as a very sweet and charming person with an exceptional wit and a very dry sense of humor and a strong passion for classic rock and roll. So what I would encourage you to do today is open your ears and listen for his humorous perspective, his passion for science and for music, and most of all, for the answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything.
Good afternoon, everyone. First, I must apologize for not being here in person. Unfortunately, my wife has been somewhat unwell the last couple of months, and although recovering, really not in good enough health to be left alone. And so I decided to film this and hope that you can enjoy the video that I've sent and engage in conversation and discussions via email afterwards, because I certainly personally miss the dialogue and the exchange that would take place here, and of course miss meeting a number of old friends in the audience that I was looking forward to making contact with again. I spent a little time thinking about this great honour that I've been awarded. I looked back at previous recipients and it was certainly never a group I expected to join, so I thank the Society for this honour. I see it as the pinnacle in my professional career. I spent a little time thinking about what I might say, and in the end I chose to talk a little bit about how I got here, who the major influences and the big events in my professional career were, so particularly in the early days, and then to speculate a little about where soil biology is going, the direction it's heading in, some recent advances in the subject, and perhaps looking into the crystal ball and say what's going to happen over the next 25 years, securing the knowledge that I probably won't be here, so you won't be able to contradict me and say what silly things I've said. This is where, in some ways, it began for me. I did my PhD at the University of London with this man, Leslie Ordus. Professor Ordus was an interesting man in many ways, but had developed his scientific interest with plant growth hormones, particularly 2,4-D and auxins and gibberellins, and it's a natural jump there from 2,4-D, and he wrote some of the early papers on what we now know as enrichment and how the speed of degradation of these compounds increases with subsequent applications in soil. And so I decided that I wanted to work for him, and he was glad enough to accept me. We were all interested in paraquat in those days, which was a compound, in a sense, revolutionised the agricultural industry. And one of the great claims for its success, or reason for success, was its strong adsorption in the soil once it was applied. Of course, it's a contact herbicide. But it was quite a reasonable carbon energy source for microorganisms, so there was some concern that it could be become available and could move through the soil and might be degraded in an appropriate pathway. And so there was some research being done there. And the advantage to me of working with Leslie Ordus is new people at ICI, Imperial Chemical Industries, that made the compound. This may not be very exciting to you now, but they had 14C label paraquat that they were prepared to give me, and that meant that using what would be regarded today as a primitive end window canter, I could do some mass balances and look at the transformations of paraquat and some of its products and measure CO2 evolution and all those sorts of things. So that was a very important part of that time. When I wasn't doing that, I was managing a supermarket on evenings and weekends to help augment my postgraduate student income. Towards the end of the time, that period, listening to the music of the time, I was strongly influenced by that in many ways, and those that know me well know that I have a lifelong interest in popular music. And the one on the bottom right must have been the biggest influence, and that's why I thought perhaps I'll go to California. And so I wrote to this man, Francis Broadbent at Davis. Whether I thought Davis was on the coast at that time, I'm not sure. I wrote to Francis Broadbent, who many weeks later, this was pre-email of course, responded and said he was passing through London en route from somewhere to somewhere, and we could meet and talk. And I remember well sitting on a park bench in Regent's Park, and he offered me a postdoc in Davis, looking at organophosphate insecticides and their degradation distribution in soils. And so not long after that, with a PhD I think of 2 days and a new wife Wendy of 4 days, we got on an aeroplane and headed for Davis. And and I enjoyed Davis enormously. It was a totally different world from London. It may still be today, full of bicycles. Learned a little bit about Mexican food, very hot, and made lots of new friends there, and really enjoyed my time there. And towards the end of the first year only, the head of that school, who I think was Connie Delwich in those days, came to me and said that someone from Berkeley had phoned and said, "We want to saw Michael Vargas, do you know anybody?" And he said, "Well, we've got an English guy here, would you like to talk to him?" And they said, "Well, send him down and we'll have a chat." So I drove that 60 miles down to Berkeley, and was taken to lunch by, I'm trying to think, Ken Babcock, and went to the faculty club there and sat down with pretty well all of the soils and plant nutrition group, as it was called in those days. Was sat next to the great Hans Jenny, who I had heard about, and who was very kind to me throughout my stay there. A really nice, encouraging man, and he said, "You're going to do well in your career, just concentrate on this, and you'll be okay." And after the lunch, or towards the end of the lunch, this man appeared, Douglas McLaren, and sat at the other end of the table, and I think studied me. And then as the meal ended and everybody got up to leave, he came round the table and said, "Do you play snooker?" I looked at him and said, "Yes, I've done that." And at that point he said, "Well, come on, let's have a couple of frames." And I learnt then in the basement of that faculty club, there were some tables. And we played a few frames and he asked me a few questions, nothing to do with science. And then we were walking back to Hillgard Hall. And I thought, "I'm going for the interview now, I wonder what form it's going to take." And I said to Professor McLaren, "What's going to happen now? Am I going for an interview?" He said, "No, you've had it over lunch and over the snooker table, and the job's yours." I don't think human resources existed in those days. So I was appointed initially for a short period of time to teach soil microbiology and do some research at Cal. And that was, again, a very important period of my life. I remember giving the first lectures I'd ever given and hoping that there were no questions, because in 50 minutes they heard all I had to know about the subject. I was always anxious about questions being asked. Made a lot of good friends, learned quite a lot, and got heavily involved in politics. This was Berkeley in the early 70s. Through Douglas McLaren, learned about soil enzymes, which I knew nothing about prior to that. And that was on the basis of a project funded by NASA, who were keen to develop ideas about measuring life on Mars when eventually a probe would land on that planet. And so, although I never really thought much about that at the time, that was my introduction to soil enzymes. McLaren was an amazing man in all sorts of ways, and he was initially my mentor, my advisor, and we became very close friends. He tragically developed what you guys know as Lou Gehrig's disease, a lateral sclerosis disease, and to early retirement, went to live in Northern California. And on a few occasions I visited him, he was getting weaker and weaker, but his brain was enormously active. And the last time I visited him, I spent the whole day talking about everything, science and other things. And he said to me, "Stick with soil enzymes, there's a lot more to be discovered." And of course he was absolutely right. And it was with Douglas that we dreamt up this positioning or location of enzymes in soil, which has developed a lot since then. And this is in our original diagram. I think that was done on a scrap of paper over a glass of wine. But we developed this on the basis of some measurements we'd made and a lot of imagination, I think, and a little bit of knowledge about soil colloids and how they might react with proteins. I remember thinking, it's alive, that's it, we've solved it. There is nothing more to know about soil enzymes. What might I study next? Of course, that was a naive view of a young scientist. I'm still in my mid to late 20s. But of course, it's grown and grown. And this rough count of the numbers of papers published in the early 70s compared to today indicates that it's a big subject, not just in soils, but in sediments and aquatic environments. And there are many, many more questions than there ever were. And of course, that's the nature of discovery of complex systems, is there are always more questions to be answered. You're one step forward and two back, or if you're lucky, two forwards and one back. There were other influences in my life, possibly. Henry Baker was an 18th century microscopist, fellow of the Royal Society, man about town, who wrote what I'd like to think of as the first microbiology lab manual, The Microscope Made Easy, published in 1743. And he also was a keen proponent of the common man having access to a microscope and seeing the wonders of the soil and the sediments and aquatic environments. But at that time, most microscopes were made of gold and ebony and ivory and leather, and were enormously attractive, decorative, but very, very expensive items, and the ordinary person could never get access, let alone afford to buy one. So he worked with his friend, the microscope maker John Cuff, and they developed a sturdy, comparatively inexpensive microscope that sold very well, and I'm sure introduced a lot of people to the wonders of the microbial world. Henry Baker papers and some of his books I inherited from my mother, and after a little bit of research, her maiden name wasn't Baker, Henry Baker turned out to be my great times five grandfather. So he might have been an influence, although a quick calculation tells me that maybe 1.5 to 7% of his DNA is coursing through my body. And the other influence would have been his father-in-law. So Daniel Defoe, the first novelist, is my great times sixth grandfather, and Henry Baker married her daughter, and there's about 0.79% of my DNA, his DNA in me. My wife Wendy thinks these might be quite significant, these influences, because one was a microscopist who wrote about science, and the other was a fiction writer, and she thought that fitted well into what I do. In 1972, I returned to the UK. I didn't have tenure at Berkeley, and there are a number of smarter people getting tenure or being turned down. And I thought, well, when I was offered this lectureship at a new university, the University of Kent, this was the time to come home. Nearly didn't make it. Our plane, we were on, had an emergency landing in Bangor, Maine. Apparently the undercarriage caught fire, and I remember looking out of the window as we made this surprising landing, and it was surrounded by people in asbestos suits. So after a couple of additional days in Bangor, Maine, eating lobster, we arrived back in the UK, and I went to the University of Kent, or joined the University of Kent, in what was a new biological science department, again full of smart young people, many postdocs having come back from the USA, and a great deal of competition as to who was really going to get through the system and be successful. And it was an excellent base for me. Plenty of European initiatives and UK research fundings, quite a bit of involvement with industry, particularly at the remediation end of my research interests. A number of other programs I was involved in, which I'm very pleased to have set up and been a part of, and collaborations all over the world, which comes to most of us in time. And it just some examples that I mentioned, that's one or two of them, has been particularly important to me. I spent 6 months at Riverside with Jim Martin, J.P. Martin, and learned a great deal about organic matter and its structure and information I didn't know before that was, again, important to me in interpreting the locations and the activities of enzymes. And Jim Martin was a charming man and quite delightful host. He would tell a story of how he did his PhD with Selman Waksman, and Waksman gave him the choice between actinomycetes and soil aggregation, and after some thinking about it, he chose soil aggregation. He used to say there went his Nobel Prize. I spent a sabbatical period at the CSIRO in Adelaide, which was in that time a hotbed of soil biology research, and worked with and got to know well Jeff Ladd and Albert Revere and other leading lights whilst I was there. And that was my first visit to Australia, and certainly was part of me deciding to come back here many years later. And then I should mention a period I spent at Corvallis, working with Richard Dick, and spending some time talking to students and postgraduates there. And it was during that time that Richard and I dreamt up the enzymes in the environment conferences, which I think Richard's in the audience, he will be pleased to tell you all about it, goes into number 5 next year, and you're all, of course, cordially invited to attend that very interesting series of conferences, which has been such a success. 1978, soil biology and biochemistry came knocking in these two people. I think Dunford Stotsky persuaded John Wade that they ought to have me on board. What was possibly an aging group of editors in those days, so I was perhaps comparatively young. And I was honoured to join, and because of that, got to know both of these people very well. Totally different personalities and characters, but both very interesting people to spend time with, again, in very, very different ways. In 2004, travelled to Australia at the invitation of Roger Swift. Initially, I'd spend just a little time, but my wife and I liked it so much that we're still there and we have become citizens of Australia. I had to learn the language, which is somewhat different from the one I'd grown up with. In case you have never been to Australia, it's obviously what g'day means, but chutes in the arvo means tutorials in the afternoon, and that took me a little while to puzzle out. Initially, or at least for 10 years, I spent my time at the University of Queensland teaching, collaborating in research and other matters, and then a couple of years ago moved up the road to the Sunshine Coast, which is north of Brisbane. And I'm now closely involved with the University of the Sunshine Coast, a new university, and what I do there isn't really science any longer. I'm involved with helping them write papers and persuade editors to accept them, and that's an interesting challenge for me and one that I enjoy enormously. This is where, when I first started out, this was soil microbiology in a very broad way. People were growing microorganisms, isolating them from soil, growing them up in culture, usually in pure culture, single species, looking at them down the microscope with some quite good stains that were being developed. We were all excited when biolog plates came along, because that gave us a physiological profile. And we thought, you know, as you always do, this is the state of the art and this will take us forward. And people counted them. They're obsessed with counting the numbers of organisms they could grow rather than direct observations. And there were huge numbers that came out of this. And we spoke about 500 different species of microorganisms per gram of soil. Described them as viable but unculturable. I always thought that was a bit of a cop-out. Well, it was effective. basically saying is we don't know enough about these microorganisms and their interaction with the chemical physical environment, their energy sources, their association with other microorganisms. We don't really know enough to be able to grow them in the test tube, in the flask. Which meant if we call them viable but uncultivable, there's about 90% of all organisms we can almost ignore. We also extrapolated from these numbers and told us there were, 7.5 times 10 to the 20 microorganisms in a hectare of soil, and they weighed them. There was some controversy between the Rothamsted systems and those from Braunschweig, and I think us young scientists in the area imagined Jameson and Donch shouting and slanging each other off and arm wrestling at meetings. I don't suppose that occurred at all, but it appeared controversial at the time, you know, which method are you using? And then some people started to try and relate in general talks, probably mostly to undergraduates, what 13 tonnes of biomass really means, and two London buses, or 100 sheep. Well, there are those in Australia. Very different today. We've got enormously sophisticated microscopy to measure or to observe microbial activity in soil in a comparatively undisturbed state in real time. We've got wonderful stains, selective stains. We've got, of course, all the molecular biology, which take us forward enormously, and given us a sense of confidence that maybe we could begin to understand what's taking place in this most complex of environments. And the numbers have gone up. We have viruses. It looks like most bacteria in soil will have viruses in them. So there are these organisms that are very much involved in regulating and controlling the microbial activities. They switch all sorts of things on and off, particularly pathogenicity. And there, of course, the archaea, what we initially called extremophiles, and it's clear that there are lots of so-called extreme environments in garden soil, and there are large numbers of these organisms, again very different in many ways to the bacteria. And based on DNA extraction, there are not 500 species per gram, but maybe 5,000 operational taxonomic units, OTUs, we don't call them species any longer. Someone with too much time on his hands worked out that if you extracted all the DNA, it would be take you out of running field, the running track. And this was not a static set of information. There's a lot of mobile DNA in soil, and under some circumstances, particularly in biofilms or at plant root surfaces, at times when there's plenty of energy, carbon and energy, there may be new forms, new OTUs being constructed all the time. And today, wasn't true many years ago, soil microbiology is always in the news. The last two are very topical, particularly the wolf on Mars, and I like the final one, because I'm going to say something about how microbes talk to each other in just a moment. And nowadays, I think we find it more easy to accept what is really obvious, and everybody knew anyway, is that microbes and plants interact with each other in communities. They communicate with each other, and that the link between above ground activity, plant growth and animals, and microorganisms is a close one, and you can't begin to understand soil microbiology unless you take that into account, even though of course it increases the complexity many fold. Here's just an example of this simple interaction involving plants and soil microorganisms. Let me mention three that we've known about for a long, long time. The importance of the rhizosphere has been evident, and many people have studied it and still do. One of these interactions from a number of years ago, again, which created excitement when I was a young scientist, was the whole process of quorum sensing, whereby pathogens, potential pathogens, produce signals, secrete signals, which inform other potential pathogens that there's enough of them, and therefore it's worth upregulating enzyme secretion. And that's what happens. You get a signaling cascade, and all sorts of enzymes, hydrolytic enzymes, are produced which degrade the cell wall and enable the reasonably high density of the pathogen to enter the cell and become a successful pathogen. And that's something that's attracted a lot of attention in all sorts of ways. Also, what runs alongside this is that the Erwinia, once it is attached and entering the plant cells, sends out other signals to bring along some microorganisms that can help it do the job, and forms biofilms. And of course, in the last 20, 30 years, the emphasis on microbial biofilms, or the research on microbial biofilms, has been enormous, and it's quite clear there are the architecture, the structure of biofilms with microbes in them at soil surfaces or at plant root surfaces is something highly complex, highly interesting, and tells us again something about how microbes function in communities and communicate. But don't think for 1 minute that these interactions are static. It's not all one way. The plant doesn't like being attacked by pathogens, and some have the capacity to secrete AHL mimics, homoserine lactone mimics, which tell the microorganism, the potential pathogen, there's a lot of you, start synthesizing enzymes and secreting them. But there isn't a lot of them. So energetically, that's disastrous for the pathogen. So the plant is fighting back. Some plants produce enzymes, which someone dubbed AHA elases, which degrade the microbial signals, but then some bacteria secrete AHLase blockers, and so on. So this is a dynamic process. Plant roots stimulate other rhizosphere microorganisms, and that will attack AHL as a carbon and energy source. But all this is quite a hot topic in a much broader sense in biology, in microbiology, about the silencing of viral and bacterial pathogens and the pathogen's response to that. So counter-offence and counter-offence and so on, and this, if you like, you could see as co-evolution in progress. These are not static systems, they're constantly moving forwards as the interactants change and respond to the presence of each other. Here's another well-known conversation that takes place in the root region that involves the mycorrhizal symbionts. You all know well about this and the importance of this to many, many plants, and what the impact of the presence of the fungus has on may have on the success of the plant. But there are lots of other aspects to this that we're only just beginning to understand really well. And it's clear, like many symbioses, it's not a truly mutualistic interaction. It's a convenient relationship given the conditions prevailing at the time. And things go wrong as far as the mutualism is concerned, and one or more of the interactants, one or the other of the interactants, they turn on each other from time to time. And I've just listed some of the things that take place in the mycorrhizal association here that tell you this is a comparatively stable interaction, but not a permanent interaction. And then, of course, to take this further, the mycorrhiza have a rhizosphere, if you like, associated with them. And then the third one, you will know well, and the sequence has been known for some while, even though, again, most people of my generation were fascinated by it when it first started to be described, and it was all something I found that undergraduates being taught the subject of soil biology were fascinated by. This sequence of events that you couldn't dream up of taking place that leads to the modulation of a legume and the capacity to fix nitrogen, the function of which is of huge importance in modern agriculture. But of course, legumes not only have rhizobia, but they also have mycorrhiza, legumes are mycorrhizal, and lots of what are called helper bacteria. And again, that's another story. 21st century soil microbiology tells us is that microbial communities represent a massive source of activities capable of responding to a whole range of chemical, physical and biological situations and circumstances. And they're robust and resilient, those terms are used a lot, but don't let's be overconfident. They may be vulnerable, and I think they probably are vulnerable to climate change, land use and industrial pollutants, and that's something that people investigate and are interested to discover more of. They develop highly developed communal structures, but they rarely function optimally as far as we are concerned. We want to manipulate them so they do what they're doing, the beneficial things they do, much better. And word of warning, in all this excitement and discovery and development in soil biology, it's easy to forget about looking carefully at the methodology, looking carefully at the data that's generated, and looking objectively at interpreting that data. This is a constraint, I think, that's perhaps driven to because of the short-term funding windows, 3 years to do a PhD, or 3 years or 5 years on a on a research program, sometimes means you're not spending quite a lot enough time looking at the early stages of designing the experiment and what you're going to do with the information, and certainly reluctantly applying the null hypothesis to your research. I know that if I send papers out to review and ask the reviewers to look carefully at the methodology, a fair number of papers get discarded at that point, because of course what follows, if that's not sound, what follows from that is that the paper's worthless. Even though the results and discussions might be very interesting, they have no value unless the work's been carefully and critically thought out. There's another thing that a lot of people think about is what we're measuring real. This is a microbial environment, and we don't have sensitive, non-destructive, real-time microenvironment techniques. And all we're measuring maybe are growth changes. Now maybe that doesn't matter. There's a limit to how many skins of this onion you can peel off. And in real practical terms, with regard to agriculture and the environment, it may be a fascinating intellectual exercise, but it may not be of any great relevance to what we really want to achieve at the end of the day. And so it might mean that you could be measuring events in your laboratory experiment or even in the field that are of no real great significance. They look significant, they appear significant, they generate significant data, but they might not matter. And one often thinks about these stop, start, success, fail processes in evolution, that the microbial world makes mistakes or makes false starts. And then that false start never goes anywhere. The sequence doesn't begin at that point to turn it into a major process. In the same way as microbes are involved to ignore short-term events, the quorum sensing story is a case in point. We have to produce signals that tell us whether it's worth doing something highly significant. And it's true of extracellular enzyme production, and all controlled by concentration, frequency and longevity of events. And I haven't explained this very well, but I'm sure many of you are aware of these sort of worries or concerns you have when you're generating information from experiments. And as I've said, time, money, publication pressures, which are huge nowadays, more than, again, when I started out, when I was doing PhDs and first supervising my students, you didn't really think about papers. Once the PhD was submitted and accepted, you then thought, maybe we could get a paper out of that. The world's very different now, and many institutions will demand that a PhD dissertation contains published papers before it could be considered. Go back. Right, in the next 25 years. Now let's speculate. I picked out about seven things which I'll mention, again, very briefly, all of which will be familiar with many of the audience, as to why we should be studying soil biology, where it's likely that where it may take us. Climate change is the first one. I don't need to bring these numbers and predictions to your attention. Some experts say it's too late, we're there already, and what we should be doing is not attempting to slow the process down significantly, but instead try and mitigate the damages and problems that's going to be caused. I think this is a rather fatalistic view, and certainly not an attitude I would have. But the consequences we're familiar with. And I don't, again, need to go through all of these, but there are major issues for soil and agricultural productivity. A soil one that is oft talked about is that soil organic matter, which you know is a recalcitrant repository of carbon, a sink, may become pools and fluxes. And if that's true, the soil organic matter, which is essential for all these things that we know well, going to decline, and we're going to lose soil organic matter, which means that it's degraded faster, which it may well be by higher levels of microbial activity as the temperature rises, as there are wetting and drying cycles, releasing some of it from its adsorbed and absorbed states, then there's more CO2 being produced, and a loss of soil organic carbon. There have been estimates in these sorts of figures, and some ideas for carbon sequestration to slow down this process. And obviously agricultural practice may make a contribution to that, to reduce the amount of aeration of soil and stimulate less microbial activity, encourage algal growth on the soil, seed lakes, and then and soil, or as I said here, transparent tubes on the roof along with the solar panels, and then convert the fixed carbon, the biomass, to roads. Lactase positive microbes in soil to increase the complex process of fumigation. That may work, I don't know, not on any great scale. And the biochar story many of you will be familiar with. So there's a feeding the world problem, and there's again terrifying numbers that are projected about the population. Would work quite well if we were all vegetarians under present crop yields, but we're not. And the FAO estimate that to keep up with global food demands, we need approximately 6 million hectares of new farmland every year, but we're losing more than that through soil erosion and other factors, so it's difficult to see how that could work out. So we must have research, innovation from government. From government and industry and money, and that's a big issue, and I'll mention that at the end just very briefly. There's no doubt that GM microplant constructs, of which I estimate there are 29 that are approved today, are going to continue to make a huge impact, although there are large numbers of opponents and countries in the world that have been reluctant to adopt these. The USA and Canada and Mexico are keen, but lots of countries in Europe and elsewhere in the world aren't. And these are the sorts of properties that people are interested in and are attempting to develop, or indeed have developed at least at a laboratory and greenhouse level. And there's no argument that, I think amongst you, there would be no argument that these are important properties of plants that may be encoded within the microbial world, that are encoded in the microbial world and can be built into the plant genome. I spoke about rhizobium early on, and there are a lot of issues still to be discussed there and developed. These questions crop up all the time. Why doesn't the population of rhizobium increase in soil? If you inoculate it, will it multiply? Will it grow rapidly? And apparently it doesn't, other than in association with the legume. There are lots of rhizobial cells in soil that don't nodulate, nor seem to respond to plant attractants, rhizospheres, polyphages and protozoal predators and so on that don't help your rhizobia. Rhizobia will penetrate and grow in other non-legume plants, but they won't fix nitrogen. How do you get your inoculants to move around and detect germinating legume seedlings? Do they always have to be encased with some sort of coating on the seeds? What limits the number of nodules per root? Oft asked question, if we get more nodules per root, we get more nitrogen fixation. Microbial strains in each nodule, they're not all doing, this is the symbiosis issue again, they're not all doing what you want them to do. The plant often imposes sanctions on rhizobia before and after nodulation, so the plant has some continuing control over this. And of course rhizobia don't work alone because, again, we come back to mycorrhiza and lots of helper bacteria. So still a long way to go, and if you're a molecular biologist studying this area, these numbers would keep you awake at night, I'm sure, because they'll all be involved in some way in the nitrogen fixation process, either directly or with carbon and energy and ATP generation by the plant. And then there are a few bacterioids, the organ in the plant that fixes the nitrogen, and the regulation and control of that is seems to me pretty complex. But there's an ultimate goal here, not least of all feeding the world, is get the nitrogen fixing genes from rhizobia into cereals and getting them to express their properties. A lot of research in this, a few reports, never confirmed that this has been achieved, but people keep going because they know there's a big prize at the end of it. So if you're in this area, you might dream about this one day. An area I've been interested in for a number of years is cleaning up the soil by microbial inoculation, and an oft-quoted mantra that microbes could do anything. It's just a question of giving them the conditions and the situation that would get them to degrade whatever there is in the soil. I'm not sure that that's true. What's in them? Well, don't need me to read this list, but there are more chemicals each year. Many of them will end up in soils and sediments and need cleaning up if you want to use that soil for the animal and crop production. Pollutants from a whole range of industries. And then a big commercial market estimated. In the USA, I see numbers like $35 billion, which suggests a source of money if you can make your argument well enough with the industries that will take these clean-up jobs on board. Not a new idea, adding microbes to soil is one way back. Interestingly, it has a sell-by date on it. You thought that was something new. The chances are this quality control in producing microorganisms was modest in those days, so whether this worked before or after the sell-by date, I have no idea. And lots of these additives on the market, approach with caution. Some work once, some don't work at all. Some don't work at all and disappear from the market shortly thereafter. But the principle is quite a good one. Add microbes to soil, get them established in competition with all the other microbes that are there. So, you know, that's a real issue. Growing microbes in the laboratory, on plates and in Erlenmeyer flasks and even in chemostats in continuous culture to utilize what you perceive as an important pollutant as a carbon energy source isn't particularly difficult, often after a prolonged period of enrichment, but getting them out into the field and getting them to survive, proliferate and express that particular degradative property is a huge leap. So often, the first three of those pictures work very well, and the fourth one leads to disappointment, and that's been true quite a bit of my research in this area. So successful bioremediation demands a number of things they've got to overcome. The solubility problems and the toxicity and possibly the recalcitrant chemical structure of the target compound. And then as time passes, these events like aging and bioavailability that change as the microbes become associated, absorbed with clays and complex inhumate matters, which makes it much more difficult for your inoculant and indeed the indigenous population to get hold of them. But don't despair, the microbial world has figured this one out. And that's pretty complex, particularly when the cellulose is associated with lignin in plant residues, but the bugs seem to do that rather well. So here are my six essential properties of rhizosphere bioremediation, of successful rhizosphere bioremediation: tolerate high concentrations of organics, extensive horizontal and vertical root systems, stimulate existing and inoculated pollutant degraders, respond to changing concentrations of pollutants and their metabolites, which could be equally toxic, scavenge contaminants from a wide area, overcome problems of bioavailability and aging. All the targets for strain selection and genetic manipulation, and that is certainly taking place. And for comparison purposes with those six essential properties, with the six essential Bob Dylan LPs, which would be the content of another lecture were you to invite me. I know you've got all these already. And then there's the issue about how you sell this technology. Not easy. And I think the last one, I'm on a little tongue-in-cheek, the last one, cleans contaminated soil and water, is a powerful one. Maybe it's the lesser of two evils if you don't believe in genetically manipulated plants and microorganisms, but if it gets rid of contaminated soil and water, then it has a much better success rate and acceptance rate with the general public. But there's a lot of work to be done there that we have a responsibility for, to persuade non-scientists that there are technologies here that could be invaluable to the quality of the environment that we live in. Astromicrobiology I won't spend much time or any time on, but there's this exciting news about the possibility of water on Mars. The reasons for having, the importance of having water is obvious to all of us. And other possible planets, satellites of planets within the solar system. But it's been a long time before soil from Mars gets back to the Earth so we can really have a good look at it. There are problems and concerns about contamination even with the remote sensing systems that we have, although there are some gene chips I understand that could be used remotely, and if there are the appropriate controls there, you might just be able to get a handle on what either is there or was there. DNA and microbial fossils can survive a long time, for a long time. It may well be that we look at microbes that were there, prokaryotes that were there rather than are there today. But that's an exciting future. Microbial diversity, well, why is that such a big deal nowadays? And it is. And a lot of it comes from the capacity to extract DNA from soil and investigate all these omics that I've got here. Don't ever use that as one word. And combine that huge amount of information with bioinformatics. And I know there are some sessions and a workshop, I think, that's going on within the context of this conference. And this is essential learning and understanding for modern soil microbiologists if they truly want to get to grips with the volume of information we're now collecting. And if microbes do have this so-called infinite metabolic potential, they of course represent a huge supply of useful properties both on the farm and in pharmacology. And if as I understand, soil host 25% of Earth's diversity, then we need to look after our soil. We need to collect soil and know how to store it. We need to collect soil microorganisms and build up culture collections of them. Maybe these are our salvation. This is our salvation, not cuddly animals and pretty flowers. It's the microbial world that we need to protect and be aware of, and the soils that they've evolved in for future reference. What's the future of soil? Here, of metagenomics, better understanding the relationships between above and below ground life, detailed analysis of the interactions and interdependencies. Maybe replace the classification of soil microorganisms to provide a fundamental insight into ecology of the soil. I don't know, and maybe discover if the evolution of humankind is all contained in the microbial world, and maybe that's the bit about conserving soil and building up soil microbial gene banks. I often think, as again many do, about nature and nurture in the microbial world, and assuming that the genomics of microorganisms, once if we ever know all about it, will tell us everything to allow us to manipulate soil biology, because the expression of these properties, of course, is influenced by everything going on around them. That we would need to understand the various switches that turn on and off these beneficial properties that we're keen to develop. I think, as I've said before, microbial properties might be measurable and regarded as important, but it doesn't mean the conditions will ever be aligned to switch on the expression of that particular property, even though it is contained within the genome of the organisms that we're looking at. And there are other things than DNA to look at. Again, as an undergraduate, I was impressed by the work of Peter Mitchell and his ideas about proton motive force, for which he won the Nobel Prize for eventually, his view would be it's energy we should be looking at. And I know that's not unlinked to the molecular biology, but it's energy we should be looking at. And as it said here, understand soil biology, follow the energy. Microbes are driven by voltage. They're also driven by DNA, accept that. Finally, soil complexity. Is this the future of soil biology? If it is, myself and probably a fair number of people in this room won't be involved in it. This is tricky. It may well be that the next generation of soil biologists will have to be involved in this as an essential course, and try to understand some, if not all, of the things in this list, which to me are mostly a foreign language, and maybe to some of you. Is the picture getting any clearer, or is it just changing? Well, this is what it might have looked like if you'd have been a soil biologist in nearly 100 years ago. This is what it looked like not very long ago. We knew it was complicated and interactive, but maybe it was in black and white. Nowadays it's in colour, so there's more definition and more clarity, but I don't know whether it's getting any clearer. And maybe this is what it will become. We'll know all the interactants and how they're interacting with each other. If you studied this, this is appropriately named the Garden of Earthly Delights, you will see the large numbers of strange looking organisms interacting with each other in all sorts of ways, and maybe that could be defined before very much longer. Taking that to the next stage of manipulating it, not at all certain. So just to summarise, where are we going to? We'll need lots of imagination, crises, political support, lots of lobbying. It's very easy for us to persuade each other that soil biology is very important and fundamental to the survival of mankind. Yeah, we all agree, but it's not helping the politicians and those that hold the purse strings to buy into that and make a massive investment, which is necessary, into moving us forward. This sounds like a Yogi Bearism, but may not be. Microbial and metabolic diversity, thousands of new species, microbial prospecting is a term word I've heard. Spatial and temporal complexity, what that means for function, new plant microbe combinations, microbial resilience, portable probes, remote sensing, real-time monitoring, rapid response. Must be room for developing a lot of these techniques and learning the language of microbes and plants and joining in that dialogue, becoming part of it as a way to changing what those relationships are. And all this leads to what someone has called Rhizosphere Engineering for Ecosystem Services. Just to finish with, you'll all be familiar with this oft-quoted Leonardo da Vinci saying, and I think it's still true, but I think the gap is closing. I think astroscience has been funded rather better than soil biology over the years, but we're getting closer. We're learning more and more about the systems we work with, but at the end of the day, I started with this black box to white box to no box at all. I think the boxes are maybe not that relevant. We need to think out of them and particularly infuse those that follow. Our grad students, our undergraduates who will be keen and excited enough by the subject to follow in our footsteps or even take their own footsteps. And this is the message that maybe we should be passing to them. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Richard in person. If you want to, you can come to the stage. We'll hand you the receiver, or I can relay your question.
Richard, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Okay, stand by. We're just going to improve the connection just for a minute, please.
Okay.
And can you still hear me, Richard?
I can hear you very well.
Your presentation and I enjoyed it very much. Thanks a lot. Is there anything you'd like
to
say first before we go into questions? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm there. I can hear you clearly.
Okay. Is there any comments you would like to make before we go into questions?
Well, I hope people enjoyed it and I hope the conference is going well and I'm with you in spirit.
Are you drinking your coffee?
Yes, I've had a couple of cups already.
Okay. Does anyone here have a question for Richard? Marianne? I'll repeat it for you.
Okay.
Richard, the question is, what are your thoughts on non-invasive, non-destructive ways to study soil biology? Do you have any ideas?
I think it's, it depends on what scale the observation is going to be made, as I think I may have indicated in my talk. Studying individual or groups of microorganisms as they function in real time in the soil demands technologies that I don't think we've developed yet. People are thinking about them and there are some ideas, and development of technology that there will be ways to do this. But as of the moment, and there may be other people in the audience, I don't think there are any really ways of doing this that would give you the confidence that what you are measuring was the real thing. And then that information could be extended to help you manage or modify or change that environment in any productive way.
Thank you. Richard, we had a question from Dr. Thompson from Rockinstead. The question is, what is the role of and the balance of studying individual species and individual activities versus studying populations as a whole?
I clearly it's room for both. You really can't write up a whole history of microbiology by saying you shouldn't look at individual populations, individual genotypes. But I think if you truly want to understand how microbes function in the environment, again, as I've talked about and as David and many of you would know, microbes don't function that way very often. There are some obviously pathogenic conditions, early stages of certain reactions where you could identify individual small groups of genotypes. But for the most part, identifying what an individual genotype does is helpful, but its regulation control is determined by the world about it. That's obviously the microbes and all the physical and chemical features of that particular environment. So I think the trend in recent years to look at microbial communities and study their collective functions is a very good one. But of course it adds to levels of complexity. And of course a lot of science that people in my generation were brought up with was controlling everything, having as few variables as possible, and then learning about whatever process you were studying by taking that almost philosophical approach. But not sure that reveals anything or a great deal about how communities function in the real world.
Okay. One of the questions related to microbial infallibility that's somewhat related to the bioremediation issue of whether or not microorganisms having the capacity to degrade man-made chemicals and applying this idea of infallibility to climate change and whether or not microbes are adapted or able to be resilient to a man-made climate change. Is that right?
That's a big question. I think those of us who have worked with microbes for a long time have a great deal of confidence in their adaptabilities. Clearly, in the environments in which they grow, they can, if they're growing rapidly, of course that obviously isn't always the case in soil, they have this immense capacity to respond to a whole range of factors and switch one proportion on the community to function fairly effectively, possibly after a delay where the second portion of the community is strongly inhibited or harmed or isn't as resilient.
questions for Richard? Okay, Richard, I don't think we have any more questions, but I just wanted to thank you so much for your presentation. And let's everyone give Richard a round of applause.
Thank you, Mary, for all your help.
Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye, everyone. Bye.